Authorization required.
Access granted.
Welcome to Discussing DevOps Details, aka the 3D Podcast. A podcast for professionals looking to uncover all angles of the DevOps world and create more efficient, more effective, and more successful organizations. Get ready to take a three-dimensional look at the practice that's taken the IT industry by storm. And now, your host, Chris Knotts.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back once again to TechTown's 3D Podcast. That's 3D for Discussing DevOps Details, where we get way down deep under the hood and talk about the actual practical aspects of adopting DevOps-style work practices in our engineering teams. I have two guests today, and these are actually two of my favorite folks who are involved in the North Carolina DevOps community here. And interestingly, my name being Chris, we also have two guests, and they're both named Chris as well. So I don't know, maybe we'll have to do like sort of a Men in Black type thing here, Mr. Bailey, Mr. Short, and Mr. Knotts. My first guest, Chris Short, very active DevOps leader, I believe now with SJ. Chris, is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Knotts.
Excellent, Mr. Short. And then Mr. Chris Bailey is the leader of our always vibrant and usually capped out with waiting list, Triangle DevOps Meetup Group. Chris and Chris, Mr. Bailey, Mr. Short, welcome to you guys. We're glad to have you guys. And Mr. Short, start with you perhaps. Maybe you can just give us a little spiel about what your current work looks like and you know, sort of what you're bringing to the DevOps discussion these days. And then without me having to respond, Mr. Bailey, well, maybe you can just chime in after he's finished and do the same.
Awesome. Thanks, Chris and Chris. So I'm a senior DevOps advocate now at SJ Technologies. And what I'll do is help companies figure out where they're lacking value in their DevOps journey and eliminate that value or automate the actual value that needs to be put in place. And then take it a step further, we can assist in, you know, kind of implementing the tooling behind that. And we're not focused on a tool or a specific software stack. We want to do what's right for our customers, which is tools they know and understand. So that's kind of where I'm at now, and kick it off to Mr. Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Short. So Chris Bailey, I'm currently the DevOps manager at Dude Solutions and driving the DevOps transformation there. I also, as Mr. Knotts said, run the Triangle DevOps Meetup Group, and I helped organize the DevOps Days Raleigh conference.
Excellent, Mr. Short, Mr. Bailey, we appreciate that. And as I said, we're just so happy to have two guys, I guess you could say, of your engineering pedigree on our podcast. Today's topic has to do with legacy stuff. Now, you know, as a learning services organization, our customers are, by and large, really large organizations. And a lot of the organizations have been around for quite some time. At this point in time, we've trained just about every government agency on some kind of tooling or, you know, or some type of cultural practice, some sort of transformative DevOps-y looking way of work. And so obviously a lot of those agencies have been around for quite a while. And then in the private sector, a lot of those organizations have been around for quite a while as well. And they're also very large. So, you know, we're dealing primarily with what Jez Humble famously called the big hairy enterprises. And it is true that there's some more difficult aspects of implementing DevOps practices, culture, and tools in this type of organization. So you guys are perfect guests for that topic today because you have some experience with this type of thing. And so, you know, before we get into any specifics, I just wanted to get general thoughts on this issue because it's very much a real world issue, you know, and I think a lot of times as folks who are involved in the DevOps community, it's easy to lose sight of, you know, just how much legacy momentum or momentum might even not be the best word around a lot of the real world types of companies who are, you know, they're very, very eager for the outcomes that are associated and hyped with DevOps. But a lot of times, you know, there's just so much siloing, so many projects in the pipeline, such broad technology portfolios, and a lot of times, a lot of pretty old infrastructure as well. You don't usually go into an organization of this size without running into some obstacles around things like mainframe. A lot of times there's also black box applications or actual hardware that has been around for a long time. And it's very difficult to refactor or redesign or to split up into smaller, more value-oriented, faster services. So, you know, it's not that our customers don't want to do these things. They just have some real impediments to actually getting past some of the existing operational infrastructure and stuff that, that, you know, business operations rely on. And obviously, you know, anybody who's read the Phoenix Project, you know, Gene deals heavily with this exact thing and the fact that there's very specialized, very old stuff that's also mission critical and, you know, they can't turn it off long enough to replace it. So so with that sort of tee up, Mr. Short, I'll kick it to you first. Have you had any experience with a situation like this? And if so, you know, maybe you can tell us a little bit about it.
Oh, Lord, I've had too much experience with this. The number one impediment to like making these kind of digital transformations or, you know, focusing more on outcomes as opposed to how you do things is just willingness to change, right? Like, it's not just, oh yeah, we're going to change some IT processes or, you know, bring in a Go developer as opposed to a .NET developer. The biggest thing you've got to focus on is like people's willingness to change. And that includes all layers of the organization, right? Like, does the CIO actually want to change? Does the person that's actually going to have to be, you know, maintaining whatever the outcome is, actually want to change anything they do on a day-to-day basis? Once you get past that, it becomes a little bit easier. But I've run into situations with several previous employers where, oh, we've always done it this way. Why would we change? Well, because clearly something's wrong if I'm here, you know? So I think that a lot of people fear change, but as technologists, you know, people that embrace technology and new things on a regular basis, we should be a lot more willing to change and, you know, automate and embrace new ways of doing things, like even small things, right? Like, when was the last time you went from, you know, ZSH to Bash to Fish or Oil or any of these other shells, right? Like, when was the last time you just tried it for a week just to see what was different about it? There's so much that people are just latch onto. It's not just tooling, but also like their day-to-day activities. I mean, Chris, I'm sure you've seen this many places in the past.
Yeah, so I will say one of my first and worst experiences as a mid-level DevOps engineer was migrating Solaris, bare metal machines to Solaris logical domains and zones. So if you can virtualize and containerize Solaris, I really feel you can do anything.
Yeah, and if any company can do that, it can't be done anywhere, right? Like, that's crazy. Right.
And I think back to, who was it? I believe his name's Gary Gruber, the HP firmware guy that really changed things and turned it around where they were deploying like once or twice a day, and they're developing firmware for these incredible legacy products.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite case studies. Actually, we give that book away in a few of our classes as a case study. Yeah, pretty incredible. You know, I mean, here you've got something. I think this is one of the reasons I like that case study so much is because, you know, it wasn't just a software shop there. You know, they had an entire corporate supply chain and a whole product line supply chain complete with, you know, manufacturing and tangible material, product design, and so forth that had to integrate. You know, Gary always starts his talks by explaining that the software the firmware was usually the last piece of the product to get delivered. You know, after all these plastic parts had been assembled and manufactured and these factories had been built and all these sort of old school supply chain factors had been met, you know, then they were still waiting on the logical piece of the product, which, you know, sets the stage for pretty abysmal current state. But I love that. I love that book. One of the things I like the most about that book is that he very explicitly explains from a leadership perspective how to attack some of the legacy components that were in the business. And in some cases, there wasn't necessarily a need to transform those components. So I remember, him discussing how there were certain teams that integrated with the overall pipeline that were waterfall teams, and some of those practices actually worked for them. And I remember that by the time the transformation was really underway, they had made the decision to keep some of those waterfall practices in place, and they integrated those with some much more sort of contemporary CI/CD practices and some more agile practices as well, and they were able to kind of orchestrate the whole effort, even though different zones of pipeline kind of did things in a different way. And I think that's a really valuable it's a really valuable thing to look at in the types of organizations we work with, because that's how they all are. There's never going to be any kind of homogeneous workflow because the orgs are just so big. And the portfolios are just so diverse. I think that was a great point. Mr. Bailey, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, and I will say with the rise of containerization, even if you have an older Windows app or anything like that, like the migration strategies there, the big thing that I've really seen is when you have legacy apps, and a lot of times these companies will do, their tiger teams, and they'll start a new application. And of course, their bread and butter money is going to be on these older Windows apps, and then they might go and do something on Linux or Node or whatever. But as that transitional phase happens and you start to see the utilization of the legacy apps drop, it's very easy to consolidate from these big honking, Windows machines down to smaller containers that, they might have been idling at 1-2% usage in their former glory. And then once you containerize them, you can actually right-size them.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing to remember is that just because some piece of legacy is legacy doesn't necessarily mean it has to be replaced, right? Like at some point in time it will. But if it's providing business value and it has, a high cost to replace, leave it and figure it out after all the other pieces come around. There, when you're going from, like a Windows, I remember back in the Windows NT days going to 2000, right? Like that was huge. And a big shift for people in a time where there wasn't a lot of automation to do it. And a lot of people, I remember, many years ago, long after 2000 was like a dead product, I'll say 2010, there was a Windows 2000 DNS server still running on an active Air Force installation. Just because it worked and it was very isolated, it was last on the list to replace.
And I will say that in DevOps, it's always fun to like chase the latest technology, and we see all these things come up and we always want to be working on the latest thing. But a lot of times when you're in a large organization, even though that stuff is amazing, you do have to remember that these legacy apps are what's typically driving the revenue for these companies. So even though it might not be the coolest new technology, it still needs to run. It still needs to be solid, or else your revenue stream drops.
Precisely, and that's really
all
that's
about really value.
Yeah, exactly. It's all about value, and I think that leads to the next question that I was going to pose to you guys, which is that a lot of times it's not so much that there's necessarily a lack of will or a lack of understanding in the organization that some of this stuff is getting really old, and there's probably some risk and some exposure from a security standpoint, just to name one timely concern, but it's mission critical stuff, and the customers just don't quite understand how to turn it off long enough to replace it. And so, I guess that's the question that I wanted to pose was, what type of rubric would you recommend to folks who are eager to adopt a newer tool or a newer piece of infrastructure, but perhaps they do have a lot of value and a lot of revenue sitting on top of something that's aging? What type of rubric would you give those people to kind of gauge, whether it's the right decision to try to refactor something or to try to update something Because it's just kind of slowly aging, but it still runs, it still delivers a lot of value. And then more importantly, it just may be really hard to land the airplane long enough to rebuild it, so to speak. And Mr. Short, I'll kick it to you first.
So I think the biggest thing is to, you know, you have to have a metric, right, that says, we have to change this because of X. And a lot of places it's, we have to change this because we can't find talent to work on it anymore. And like, once you've hit that point, you've waited way too long. So you have to realize that you have to bring in talent that can accomplish a goal on a new platform at that point, right? Like if you have everything on a mainframe and it's in COBOL and you know that you can't have the mainframe anymore for whatever reason, or you know, everything's on Windows, you need it on Linux and it's in .NET and you want it in Java, whatever the case may be, you have to sit there and realize that at some point in time, you're going to have your new thing and your old thing running simultaneously right next to each other. And you're going to have to do some testing between the two to actually figure out, like, is the functionality going to be the same? You're actually going to have to send real world traffic to the new thing at some point and make sure that it actually works as you gradually move towards the new thing. You don't have to turn one thing off and turn one thing back on, but you probably will have to duplicate that thing before you can just shut it off and put it aside. And that's kind of like the lift and shift mentality. When you see people migrating to the cloud, they have their existing, you know, data center infrastructure running, but then they're moving chunks of it over to like an AWS or a Google or an Azure, just so they can move something, right? Like start small and then start moving everything over.
Yeah, and I think you can see some of the challenges as well in legacy infrastructure. If you're headed towards a newer stack and you're looking towards modern monitoring and modern CI/CD, a really interesting thing to do is actually to go back and try to see how much of that legacy product that you can monitor and how much of it that you can implement with CI/CD. Make that pipeline pretty smooth. In the case of legacy, if you're still writing, you know, code to support it, which typically companies are, it kind of gives you somewhat of a dry run for your more modern stuff, and also allows you to get a better idea of a usage and all that.
Yeah, those are great points. So, in other words, you know, even if you have perhaps some slightly older infrastructure in place, maybe there's room just to update. Maybe some process, or maybe even to implement some additional visibility or some additional feedback, maybe some additional tools that assist with those processes, so that the underlying infrastructure layer might not necessarily be the first thing that you have to update, but you can actually perhaps kind of leverage more value on the infrastructure you have with slightly more modern tooling and process. Would you guys agree with that?
That is certainly a good approach, yes.
So, you know, we talk a lot about, I think anybody who's involved in DevOps is familiar with this thing that we call the strangler pattern, right? So, Mr. Short, that sounds a little bit like what you're getting at there a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got some things running concurrently, you can do some testing, start sending some real world load through the new thing while the old thing still continues to function. So let me ask you guys about the strangler pattern. Is this, you know, something that you've seen implemented in a practical way, and is that the same thing as what you're talking about, Mr. Short? And you just tell me your thought on that, and then Mr. Bailey, you can chime in afterwards, maybe.
Well, I think it's definitely a great approach to take, but what what happens a lot of times is that it takes longer than you expect, or there's, you know, unforeseen circumstances because you don't have all that skilling that built that original like monolithic app to help you detangle the mess that it is. So you'll find yourself maybe doing some cost overruns at a cloud provider, or potentially not having enough resources initially to do what you thought would be, you know, X turns out it's X and Y and maybe a little bit of Z too. So that, you know, it's something you have to manage as you're progressing along. And the biggest thing is that you wouldn't run your operation without some kind of financial checks and balances and figuring out, you know, what is this going to cost us long term? The same approach applies to whatever your migration strangler or not strategy is, you can't just sit there and say, we're going for this and, you know, cost be damned, unless everybody's on board with that. So if you're using this approach, right, you know, in that typical, like, here's our original workflow, here's our original tool sets, now we're going to build this other thing on the side, you're going to have at least, you know, 100% more stuff eventually, if not more. So the ideal situation would be you can actually financially and, you know, physically sustain that kind of increase in infrastructure.
Yeah, and it's funny to think about, because a lot of times, unless you're starting from the ground floor, we do this in DevOps, right? You come in, you implement a much more modern monitoring system over, say, a Nagios, but during that time period, you don't want gaps in data, so you're slowly sunsetting the Nagios alerts and monitoring as you spin up your brand new, you know, Grafana stack.
Yeah, the amount of new tooling that you'll find and then realize is not the right thing, and you go to the next thing, especially when it comes to monitoring. That's very much a real thing that happens sometimes with these migrations.
I'm sure it would have to be, because I think about the book Continuous Delivery, which sort of laid the foundation, the blueprint, or at least a loose framework for a lot of the CI/CD practices that are being striven for, and increasingly, you know, successfully adopted. And then I think, you know, that book came out in 2011, you know, 7 years ago, and in 2011, you know, there was no Docker, and so it seems almost crazy to think about, you know, setting up a CD pipeline and things like that the way Jez describes. But, you know, never to mention containers and things like that, and never to maybe think about, you know, some of the more recent emergent tools that we have for orchestration and things like that, you know, because obviously something like orchestration is addressed, but, you know, I think there's just been a lot of change just even in the last few years about that. So, you know, guys, maybe you could speak just to the orchestration point for a moment as well, because I know, you know, that's a real pain point that we often run into. You know, people just don't really know where to start because they're not exactly sure how to implement orchestration that's sophisticated enough to even allow them to begin to kind of refactor this stuff. And I've been kicking it to Mr. Short first, so I want to switch it around and let Mr. Bailey go first this time.
It's an interesting thing of starting to implement orchestration. And again, I think it just goes back to that strangler pattern of doing small steps at a time. I really do think the more that I continue in this role, the more I really realize that, yeah, you just can't do it wholesale. You know, you really do have to slowly take the pieces out, vet them, test them. Is this working? Spin up. And then, you know, go from there. So, I really think across all the domains, including DevOps and software engineering, I mean, it applies everywhere, and you can really see that it has value.
Well, it's a lot like building a house, right? So you don't pour the foundation, build the walls, set the roof, put shingles on all in one day, right? You start somewhere, you know, and you pick a direction and you build. Same goes for literally everything, you know, that we are doing in DevOps nowadays, is that you have to start somewhere. So you choose your starting point, and then you know what your outcome should look like. And, you know, you could look at it as kind of like, you know, a race, like a car race, you know, NASCAR, F1, whatever you're racing. Start at the end, figure out, you know, I need to do pit stops here. There could be weather here, so we need to be ready for, you know, X, Y, and Z. And then all the way back to the beginning, where you've laid out your whole plan, but you work backwards to say, we have to address this, 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 and then start breaking down those smaller things into smaller chunks of work so that you could literally get them into 2 week sprints, working with, you know, that, you know, ubiquitous two pizza team mindset, moving forward on, you know, everything iteratively but releasing frequently.
Yeah, and so to jump in real quick here, I am a huge Formula One fan, and I really enjoy waking up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning to watch. But Chris brings up an amazing point. Chris Short brings up an amazing point. the way a Formula One team works, of course, is they are watching the radar and they're watching for weather to come in, and they're analyzing everything, right? They're looking at how the tires are wearing, when's our next pit stop, when are we going to have a gap to our competitors. What it shows you, and when you see a highly performant team like a Formula One team, is that the way to do any of this stuff is with data. If they didn't have this data, if they didn't have all this telemetry, and at the Formula One level, they monitor everything, temperatures, mm-hmm. everything, you know, they know how far the car can drive to the foot on their fuel load. And I really think in the same way, when you're doing any sort of these migrations, the more data that you can have about your legacy systems, the easier it's going to be for you to plan what it takes to get them to a more modern orchestration.
And it's not just the planning phase, it's the actual implementation phase, right? You know that previous system performed like X when, you know, this event happened. During the Super Bowl, your company had an ad, this is what happened to your legacy system. Like, you have to know that when the Super Bowl comes for you on the new system. So you have to continually be ingesting data, processing it, and then adjusting as necessary to fix whatever outcomes, you know, are unexpected. Then at that point, you can tackle more and more things. So as you're kind of moving towards your new stack, you're going to find yourself having more and more people operating it than building it. So you have to, you know, staff your team and, you know, break up the workload with that in mind.
And I really buy into the whole imagery, and I think it's great for just describing DevOps in general, but with this is building the plane while it's in flight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very much putting the wings and flaps on this thing as the fuselage is soaring towards the ground, yes.
you guys brought up several really good points there, which I couldn't agree with more heartily. Mr. Bailey, you keep kind of going back to the point about the data, and you've mentioned several times during this conversation how important the visibility is, the monitoring, an understanding and ingestion of the data, and then having sort of an intelligent way to consume and analyze that data. Now, I want to work, and we're coming to the end of our time here, but I want to just pose one more question to you guys, and it's a bit more specific, and that's around a different type of data, because of course you're talking about, you know, monitoring data and performance data across your systems, but you know, I can tell you from the trenches that a lot of times a lot of the challenges to doing the type of work that we've been talking about during this conversation arises around the enterprise data. And you know, now you mentioned Solaris at the top of the chat, and I thought that was a pretty funny point. But you know, we have customers who are running all kinds of stuff that I don't typically hear associated with DevOps practices. You know, things like Salesforce or SAP or you know, something like that, as well as just huge stores of customer data. And a lot of times that seems to be one of the real technical impediments to sort of deconstructing your pipeline and your infrastructure work into smaller, more agile chunks, things that you can manage a little more closely. You know, it's because the risk is just so high. There's risks to customer data. There's risks to, you know, if you do break something, it could be really hard to fix. And speaking of, I just want to take a second to plug you guys' podcast, because you guys do a podcast called Set Up for Failure, and I just think that is a great name for a DevOps related podcast. But obviously, you know, we know that anticipating and responding quickly to failure when it happens is a really big ingredient in the DevOps cookbook. But it seems like the enterprise data is often a pain point that just, you know, they just can't get over the hurdle because it's just so painful, and the risk is just so high if something does break. So that's my final question for today's conversation. And once again, Mr. Bailey, maybe I'll let you take a crack at that one first.
So I think in that case, you know, just trying to minimize the amount of pain. So at the end of the day, some of those things are going to be like tearing the Band-Aid off, right? Like, okay, we're going to have to do a migration. This could go poorly. Having a great rollback strategy, having everything documented, orchestrating as much as possible and automating so you're hands off during that transition. I know the larger the enterprise, it typically appears the more adverse to change. And I think, you know, if you come, it all rolls back, I guess, to data for me. Is like if you go to your CTO or your senior VP or whatever, and you say, here's the exact plan that I'm going to go or that we are going to go with for this migration. Here's exactly how it's going down. Here's what happens when we fail. Here's how we're going to get all your data back. Everything's going to be fine. You're not going to be woken up at 2 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, if you wake up and we're on the old stuff, then, you know, we failed and we'll learn from it and we'll try it again and we'll make sure it's all documented. But I think going into those in a large enterprise organization, you really do have to have a plan and you have to be able to present to your higher levels with data and saying, here's where we know we've looked at the edge cases. We know where this could break. We know where this could go wrong. And we have a plan to get back to where we were if we fail.
The biggest thing when it comes to any kind of transition is your willingness to embrace failure and learn from it. And, you know, to talk about like Salesforce or, you know, actually touching real data, like that state, that business logic state is so vital to an organization. The biggest thing you can do, especially with some of these SaaS services where you're just making API calls or through orchestration layer, you're changing something, put an API in front of their APIs and make sure that you're building safety into your solution. So like you have like a no op or do not execute flag that's on by default until you're ready to turn it off permanently or make it optional. And then at that point, you're mitigating risk by saying, talk to this API, talk to this API only, and, you know, add on to it to create new functionality with the existing SaaS API so that we can add this feature of, you know, don't actually munge the data when I tell you to just test this thing. Then let the floodgates open up and migrate from there. You know, Chris brings up a good point with documentation, rollback procedures. You have to know these things before you jump into it. And I have a very good story about migrating from MS SQL servers to Amazon's RDS, and just, you know, we learned the first night trying to transition everything over with this monolithic app so much that we didn't realize that we actually at like 2 a.m. we actually said, okay, we're gonna pull the plug on this, we're gonna go back, we're gonna get some sleep, we're gonna try this again later, and everybody document what you learned tonight, and we'll come back, you know, in 24 hours and figure out what we did. And how we can learn from it. And that's like the biggest thing, right? Is knowing when to pull the plug and say, even if we got past this next hurdle, there's going to be another one. And it's time to just let everybody get some rest.
Very well said. Yes, indeed. Well, unfortunately, that brings us just about to the end of our time. But I'll give you guys one more shot at any final words, any closing thoughts, and perhaps we'll let Mr. Bailey go first, and then Mr. Short, you can close us out.
Yeah. So again, if this is a transition that you're going through, I would again say try to collect as much data as humanly possible. The higher up in the organization that you go, especially an older enterprise, the more that they're going to want to mitigate risk and they're going to want to understand the consequences. So even if you're at that ground level of the DevOps engineer, making sure that you understand the business implications and also that you're trying to mitigate the risk is going to be the biggest sell.
Yeah, the biggest thing I think people try to do that it ends up, you know, kind of costing them a long run. You know, we're going to do this transition in a vacuum, right? Like, I'm going to talk to, you know, only people within my company about this. You know, bringing in somebody to do it for you is not like the best solution either. But you should at least seek out community kind of advice, right? Talk to people at your local DevOps meetups. Talk to people, you know, on Twitter, right? Like, you can ping me on Twitter at Chris Short. I'll talk to you. I'll pick up the phone, call you, see what I can do to help you. Because the last thing I want anybody to do is, you know, do all this work and it not work out, right? Like, it'd be a failed DevOps transition or some sort that, you know, leaves a bad taste in like a whole company's mouth. And now you've got some other poor guy, poor team that can't make this thing change later because, oh, we tried this once and it went awful and we're never going to do this again. 20 years later, the company's gone, or 5 years later nowadays. So, you know, embrace the DevOps community and get some outside advice when you can.
Well, guys, those are great points to close with. Really strong advice. And again, just want to say thanks to you guys. It's a real pleasure to have two such senior engineers on our podcast. It's been really great. And I also just want to thank everybody for listening and plug once again, y'all's podcast, Set Up for Failure. Everybody should definitely check that out. Chris Bailey and Chris Short, Set Up for Failure. And you can hear about more of their adventures and misadventures. And as for me, I'm Chris Knotts. And this has been another little episode of the TechTown 3D podcast. And that's 3D for discussing DevOps details. And we hope that you will join us again soon.
I think Thanks, we should change everybody. The name to Three Chris's. I'm just going to say
that. 3C. It's just one letter. It's just one letter. Thanks, guys. We'll talk to you.
Take it easy.
Bye.
This podcast is brought to you by TechTown Training, making organizations more efficient, more effective, and more successful every day.